Welcome to another edition of the Truth Hurts program. Let's get started. Welcome back to another edition of the Truth Hurts program with your host, me, Steve Z. It is Thursday, the 28th day of October, 2021. We are just about to the end of Joe Biden's 10th month as the President of the United States. I want to try just to go through some headlines with some brief commentary this morning because there is so much to talk about, and I do tend to get off on long rants on these stories. And the idea, of course, for doing a 30-minute podcast is to try and get in a whole bunch of information in 30 minutes. And if I dwell too long on one subject, we only end up talking about one thing. So here we go. According to The Hill, progressives scramble to save top priorities from the chopping block. It says the plan of Joe Biden's social spending, so-called Build It Back Better BS plan, and his social safety net plan are in heap big trouble. Democrat leadership is hoping liberals will embrace the bill, even though it's substantially smaller than the total $6 trillion originally envisioned by the left, or even the reduced $3.5 trillion approved under the budget resolution earlier this year, solely along Democrat Party lines. Liberal lawmakers are warning that Democrats need to make good on the promises they made to voters, because, after all, they don't want to get caught lying, right? They delivered the party its first trifecta in a decade during the 2020 election, where the Biden king came to power, and Nasty Nancy Pelosi and Chuckles the Clown Schumer held on to their leadership roles. What we're seeing now is a real clash. A, on one hand, people want real change. B, on the other hand, you're seeing the powerful special interests saying, sorry, we want the status quo. This according to crazy Bernie Sanders. Pocahontas Elizabeth Warren said several priorities were in flux because this is what happens in negotiation. She said, you know, there's a lot of pieces, and as you know, we have no margin for error. We need all 50 Democrats. We made promises in the last election, and we need to deliver on those promises. Though Democrats feel they're on the cusp of clinching a deal on a framework for a spending bill, including a top-line number, many of the progressives' largest policies are probably going to be on the chopping block. Well, my apologies for the interruption. We just had a power outage here at Studio 63. The Generac 22kW whole house generator just kicked on, and we're still here, so that's good news. Pardon all the noises in the background as the equipment and the printers and the monitors and the other laptop computers and the desktop computers all kick back on. Democrats are engaged in an intense behind-the-scenes negotiation as they try to figure out a way to keep the top progressives' priorities in the bill, even if they're smaller than originally envisioned. Here's the deal. Congresswoman of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, Pramila Jayapal of Washington, warned this week there will not be a deal without progressive sign-off. In other words, give us everything you can, or you get nothing. She said, we are pushing as hard as we can to get as much as we can. Nobody should take progressive votes for granted. There is no deal until everything is agreed to by everybody. Yes, I know, she doesn't really talk like that, but it sure is fun. Democrats, after closed-door caucus meetings on Tuesday, said they're still ironing out family paid leave, climate change provisions, and taxes targeting billionaires. They're still trying to win over support from the moderates for expansions of Medicaid and Medicare, with the party viewing the bill as its best shot in years to enact sweeping health care legislation. But I thought Obamacare was the end-all be-all. I thought Obamacare was going to make medical everything for the people. I guess Obama failed. Crazy Bernie Sanders is drawing a red line around including expanding Medicare to cover hearing, vision, and dental, and giving Medicare the ability to negotiate lower drug prices, which will probably result in higher drug prices. Sanders said, the bottom line is that any reconciliation bill must include serious negotiations on the part of Medicare with the pharmaceutical industry, lower the cost of prescription drugs. That's what the American people want. Serious reconciliation bill must include expanding Medicare to cover hearing aids, dental, and eyeglasses. Yeah, okay. Whatever, Dave. Progressive senators claim to be in talks with Kyrsten Sinema to try and get a Medicare drug negotiation plan included. Progressives have seen some key priorities already sidelined, including higher corporate tax rates, clean energy electricity performance programs, paid family and medical leave, down already from 12 weeks to 4 weeks, will likely go away altogether. Democrats are increasingly feeling bullish that they'll be able to get some kind of deal on climate provisions ahead of Gropey Joe heading over to Scotland to discuss methane emissions now having a fee attached to them. The fee, of course, goes into the general spending fund and will do absolutely nothing to change emissions. Slight change of topic, but somewhat still on the same topic. Naughty, Nazi, nasty Nancy Pelosi has vowed she will not bring the bipartisan infrastructure bill to vote on the House floor until Democrats have assurances that the Senate will accept the final agreement on a social spending package without any further changes. Jayapal stated on Tuesday that dozens of progressive caucus members will vote against the so-called bipartisan infrastructure bill if there's only a framework on the greater social spending package and not actual legislative text ready for House floor consideration. Remember, House Democrats can only afford three defections to clear the bipartisan infrastructure bill on their own, but there may be a little more wiggle room depending on how many Republicans are forced to vote for it. Either way, my friends, however you look at it, it's falling apart for the Democrats. Thank God, that's the only hope left for the United States of America. Remember the Democrats, the progressives, the socialists, the liberals who want it all to be a kumbaya country? They want us all to come together as long as we agree 100% on their viewpoint and 0% on our own viewpoint. Well, MSNBC host Mehdi Hasan supports segregation. You heard me correctly. Supporting segregating those who are unvaccinated against the coronavirus and denying those segregated American citizens access to basic goods, services, and health care. Remember, folks, it's about public health. It's definitely not a New Age religious cult whose most zealous adherents believe that the path to salvation is through punishing the wicked unvaccinated unbelievers. Hasan's comments in support of isolating the unvaccinated came this week in reference to public remarks made by left-wing nutjob Noam Chomsky. The 92-year-old is still alive, by the way. The radical left-wing socialist Chomsky said during an interview this week that the issue of vaccine mandates, in other words, forcing the unvaccinated to either accept vaccines or face a specific set of consequences, is what he says a mixed story. Chomsky suggested there must be a compromise struck between individual freedoms and liberties and public health, adding that society itself should form some sort of social convention where unvaccinated persons are all pushed into isolation. Now, how could this be achieved on a practical level? What happens when the unvaccinated, say, need to purchase food? Chomsky had an answer to this question. How can we get food to them? He asked. Well, that's actually their problem. And that's where MSNBC's Hasan, who's all too happy to have unvaccinated treated as another class of people, said, "Sign me up." The MSNBC host said this week, "Noam Chomsky is trending because he wants to get tough on people who choose to stay unvaccinated. Good for him." Later in that interview, Chomsky said, "People who refuse to accept vaccines, I think the right response for them is not to force them to, but rather to insist that they be isolated. If people decide I'm willing to be a danger to the community by refusing to vaccinate, then they should say, well, I also have the decency to isolate myself. That should be a convention. Enforcing is a different question. It should be understood, and we should try to get it to be understood. If it really reaches the point where they are severely endangering people, then of course you should do something about it. So I think we should first attempt to establish conventions that will be understandable by people with some moral capacity to try and convince them that it's your right to refuse to get a vaccine, but it's your responsibility to isolate yourself so you do no harm to others." Listen, this virus, this publicity stunt, this Wuhan, China flu kills less than 0.002% of people who get it, and less than 0.003% of people in general. So what these people are talking about is the creation of a caste system between the clean and unclean, the vaccinated and unvaccinated, denying the unvaccinated access to goods and services, food, medical attention, all for the sake of a general reduction in the transmission of the China virus, which is not nearly as deadly as many other sources of death in the United States of America. Ridiculous. Funny thing is, when Donald Trump was touting the fact that under his administration, these vaccines were created, these vaccines were discovered and manufactured, and we were getting a million shots into the arms of Americans every single day, it was those on the left who opposed it, saying, "I'm not taking a shot if Donald Trump invented it. Day. My, how the tables have turned and how the double standard rears its ugly head once again. This is the Truth Hurts program. Paul Bettard writes in the Washington Examiner, "Push for the AOC Prevention Act to stop the spending binge. Conservatives fearful of President Gropey Joe Biden and liberal Democrats piling on waves of regulations and new spending are pushing back with a new effort to rein in Uncle Sam before it's too late and the dream of limited government goes poof. We've got to have a conversation. The left loves to have national conversations. We've got to have a national conversation," said Clyde Wayne Cruz Jr., the policy director at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He's leading a campaign to stop the government's knee-jerk reaction to manufactured crisis after manufactured crisis by spending and regulating. Cruz said this has happened since 9/11, the 2008 financial meltdown, and now the Wuhan, China novel coronavirus pandemic crisis that isn't really a crisis. "What's the next one going to be?" he said. He assured us there will be one. While liberals, led by Gropey Joe Biden, Camel Toe Harris, Senator Bernie Sanders, Representative Alexandria Horseface Cortez, have continued to pursue big spending and regulations, totaling nearly $5 trillion in spending plans as of today, Cruz has drawn up a different path that opens the door for more private wealth building and problem solving that doesn't mortgage the future for our children, grandchildren, great and great-great and great-great-great-grandchildren. He calls it the Abuse of Crisis Prevention Act, better termed the AOC Prevention Act, a bow to the influence that supposedly is wielded by Alexandria Horseface Cortez of New York. "I just thought it was kind of cute, but it's a serious thing," he said. "It would cut regulation, limit national emergency declarations, and basically starve the government of money and shift that money back to citizens. The result? Business would be bolstered and liberties would be expanded. It's much more of a crisis what's happening to the Constitution and what's happening to limited government and what's happening to normalcy in the United States with respect to our daily lives than the manufactured crisis after crisis after crisis that the Democrats have used to rule by decree." This plan was first presented in Forbes, where six goals were listed. Number one, continual regulatory liberalization instead of stimulus. Number two, circumscribe emergency declarations. Number three, starve government while feeding household intergenerational wealth. Number four, strengthen business resilience by shrinking the state and leaving funds where they were earned. I'm all for that one. Number five, clarify distinctions between federal and state purview and roles. And of course, number six, the all but missing in our government, discipline. Expansion of government is, alas, nothing new, and there is no reset at all. It's more, it's lots more of the same. The Abuse of Crisis Prevention Act, the AOC Prevention Act, would embody genuine reset in the proper meaning of restoration of our constitutional liberties and principles, in particular, vesting of power in the individual rather than the state, and repudiating the imposition of modern social engineering upon one's federal citizens. That is a great piece. Thank you very much for that. On this morning's earlier program, I mentioned that the Democrat nutjobs in California are trying to now penalize the boats that are sitting out there in the water waiting to go to port. Penalizing them because of California's own failure to have enough trucks and truck drivers, and because of California's kowtowing and catering to unions who said, "No, we only work 7 to 3:30 Monday through Friday." The ports at Long Beach and Los Angeles are looking to crack down on congestion with a new surcharge for ocean liners import containers that linger in marine terminals. Under a new policy that takes effect November 1st, ports will charge ocean carriers for each container scheduled to move by truck that dwells at marine terminals for more than 9 days. It's not the ocean carrier's fault. It's the state of California's fault. Meanwhile, for containers moving by rail, the ocean carriers will be charged if the container has sat on the dock for 3 days or more. Ocean carriers with cargo in these two categories will initially be charged $100 per container, with incremental increases of $100 per container per day. Fees collected will allegedly be reinvested by the two ports for programs designed to enhance efficiency, accelerate cargo velocity, and address congestion impacts throughout the San Pedro Bay. Are you kidding me? It's not the ocean supplier's fault, the carrier. It's not that boat's fault that you can't clear those containers off of your port. I could go on and read this entire article, but it's an absolute joke. These ocean carriers would end up spending millions, if not billions of dollars each year because there are lazy longshoremen over there on the ports who aren't moving the cargo fast enough. My suggestion to the captains and owners of these ocean vessels, pull up anchor right now. Just pull up your anchor, steam down to the Panama Canal, come across, head over to Florida or the Port of New Orleans, nice major ports that are waiting for your cargo, with truck drivers just dying to haul those containers anywhere they need to go. Come on over to the Gulf Coast. Come on over to the East Coast. There are plenty and plenty of dock berths waiting for you. And to hell with California and their ridiculous onslaught of regulations and charges and fees and taxes. It's ridiculous. We'll head back to the Washington Examiner, where the article headline says, Biden's poll numbers are even worse than they seem. President Gropey Joe Biden's dropping poll numbers are worse than they seem. A deep dive into the data shows two overlooked problems that most news stories haven't caught. An intensity problem and a national mood problem. An intensity problem happens when a politician's hard negative ratings rise much higher than his or her hard positive ratings. Voters who hold strongly negative views are less likely to shift to the positive side than voters are who only hold somewhat negative views. And that will spell trouble for the Democrats in the next election. Let me put it another way. Biden supporters tend to only be so-so in their esteem and love for the Groper-in-Chief, while people who are against Joe Biden are passionate in their hatred towards him. And their hatred is justified. In a recent Quinnipiac University poll, for example, Biden's overall job approval rating is only 40%. 53% disapprove, and that, my friends, is not good for Gropey Joe. When you look at the internal numbers that didn't make it to the headlines, it gets far worse. The number of voters who strongly disapprove of the job Gropey Joe is doing is more than twice those who strongly approve of the job he's doing. 45% strongly disapprove, while just shy of 20% strongly approve. The same is true for Gropey Joe's personal popularity. Amongst voters, he's 40% favorable and 51% unfavorable in an Economist poll. However, the very unfavorable is much larger than the very favorable, 40 to 26%. Biden has an intensity problem when it comes to handling of important issues. The Economist polling found that almost twice as many voters disapprove of Biden's handling of jobs and of the economy than those who strongly approve. 39% hate him, 20% claim to like him. In addition, 35% strongly disapprove of Biden's performance on health care, while only 17% strongly approve. 35% strongly disapprove of his handling of abortion issues, while only 15% strongly approve. And on crime, the numbers are ridiculously staggering. 38% strongly disapprove of Biden's handling on crime, while less than 12% strongly approve. A core Democratic issue is civil rights, right? Biden's approval rating is underwater. 42% approve, 47% disapprove. Adding to that sting, strongly disapprove is more than twice than those who strongly approve. And on immigration, it's worse. On the issue of immigration, the September survey found Biden's approval rating is 24%, with 61% disapproving. Let's look at the intensity, though. On the immigration crisis that Biden created, 43% of those polled strongly disapprove of his handling, and only 4% strongly approved. None of this is good news for Democrats. Just like it wasn't good news for Republicans when Trump's hard negative ratings wreaked havoc on his party in the 2018 midterms. At that time, the GOP lost 41 House seats. Now, they're thinking that Mr. Biden will cost the Democrats as many as 54 to 58 seats in the House, and that can only be good for America. I want to switch gears and talk about Kyle Rittenhouse. You may or may not remember, young Kyle Rittenhouse was a 17-year-old who was performing medical treatments for people as a medic during the riots this last year after the death by drug overdose of the criminal thug animal George Floyd, who happened to be in police custody at the time of his demise. A Wisconsin judge ruled on Monday that attorneys in the Kyle Rittenhouse murder trial could refer to the men Kyle Rittenhouse shot as rioters, looters, and arsonists. They could not, however, describe Joseph Rosenbaum and Anthony Huber, who were killed, or Gage Grosskreutz as wounded or victims, because the term was loaded, the judge said. The ruling comes ahead of what is expected to be a contentious trial. The then 17-year-old Rittenhouse shot the men in downtown Kenosha, Wisconsin, with an AR-15-style rifle after he crossed state lines during the riots and public unrest that was sparked by the shooting of another thug named Jacob Blake by a white cop. Rittenhouse was with fellow armed men who had tasked themselves with patrolling Kenosha's streets amid the chaos. That statement is a lie. Supposedly, Rittenhouse was being hired to protect a single business and was out there on his own with medical gear to help not only rioters, but cops or anyone who might have become injured in the riot amid that chaos. Circuit Judge Bruce Schroeder laid out final ground rules before next week's trial begins. Rittenhouse faces homicide charges, even though he was attacked by these three guys. He was attacked. He's pled not guilty to all charges. He did act in self-defense, and video evidence will prove this. Of course, in today's society, who cares what the evidence says? As long as you pander to a certain 13% hyphenated minority, the law only applies to certain people. Democrats have always had a problem with numbers. They make up the numbers to suit their needs, and when you call them out on the fact that their numbers are completely wrong, they just laugh at you. Or they tell you that you're not understanding. Horseface Cortez herself, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, claimed on Sunday that, quote, almost 10 people, unquote, died from the Capitol riot on January 6th. That's an inflated estimate that apparently includes those not killed directly during the mayhem. The wide-eyed New York Democrat said the so-called terror attack left 138 injured and almost 10 dead. Now that's completely wrong. The actual fact that only one person was directly killed in the act. If you recall, there was only Ashley Babbitt, an unarmed United States Air Force veteran. Unarmed. She didn't even have a cell phone in her hand. And she was gunned down by a cowardly 13% AA hyphenated American Capitol Police lieutenant who still has yet to be charged in her cold-blooded murder. In her being deprived of her civil rights. This is what the clown tweeted, Alexandria Ocasio-Horseface-Cortez.
Any member of Congress who helped plot a terrorist attack on our nation's capital must be expelled. This was a terror attack. 138 injured, almost 10 dead. Those responsible remain a danger to our democracy, our country, our human life in the vicinity of our capital and beyond.
The only death, as I said, was that of Ashley Babbitt, who was murdered in cold blood by a black Capitol police officer. Babbitt was a white woman, former Air Force veteran. She visited the Capitol to support former President Donald Trump. Horseface Cortez's estimate likely referred to deaths of Trump supporters Kevin Greeson, Benjamin Phillips, who died of heart problems. They were listed as hypertensive, atherosclerotic, cardiovascular disease, and their deaths were called by natural causes. Of course, the bug-eyed bartender was also likely including the death of Rosalind Boylan, 34, whose accidental death was precipitated by, quote, acute amphetamine intoxication, unquote, better known as drug use, or Capitol Officer Brian Sicknick, whose cause of death on January 7th, whose official cause of death was natural, a stroke. Basically, brainstem and cerebellar infarcts due to acute basilar arteries thrombosis. In other words, he had a stroke. So let me add this up. Ashley Babbitt murdered by a black Capitol cop. That's one actual death. Not 10, not almost 10. Two guys died of a heart attack, one died of a drug overdose, and one had a stroke, natural causes. Total all of those is 5. And 5 is not nearly 10. 5, in fact, is half of 10, but the actual number was 1. Horseface, 1. On Monday, a handful of Republican politicians lashed out at a report accusing them of involvement in planning details of rallies and electoral certification objections on January 6th, ahead of the riot, as they're calling it, at the Capitol building, either personally or through staff. Democrats have accused their Republican counterparts falsely of culpability, with Horseface Cortez alleging that Ted Cruz, quote, almost had me murdered, unquote, by supporting the objection to the certification of gropey Joe Biden's questionable victory. She says she's been in therapy due to the trauma of the January 6th riot. But you know and I know the real fact. She was not at the Capitol that day. She was in the Congress office building, a few blocks away from the Capitol. She had no knowledge of what was going on until someone came to check on her, and then she basically attacked them. They don't want to hear the truth, because to them, the Democrats, the truth hurts and could be very harmful to their chances of being reelected. Everyone who listens to the Truth Hurts program understands fully that I am not a fan of Dr. Anthony Fauci. Apparently, neither is Paul Bettard. He writes in the Examiner poll, Fauci lied, resign. Nearly half the nation believes that COVID-19 czar Anthony Fauci lied about funding virus testing in China. And almost as many want him dumped from the post that he's held for over 37 years. In the latest Rasmussen report survey, 49% say that Fauci did not tell the truth about U.S. funding for gain-of-function research. When asked whether he should be forced to resign as the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, 46% say yes. The survey followed the recent release of a memo suggesting that the U.S. did support and fund virus testing in China, where COVID-19 was developed. This prompted a new round of calls led by Senator Dr. Rand Paul to fire Fauci. Oh, he's beloved by his fans, but despised by critics of vaccine and mask mandates. Rasmussen said the release of the National Institutes of Health memo contradict Fauci's denial that federal funds had been used to fund controversial research in the Wuhan, China laboratory, and that that has cut severely into Fauci's credibility. The latest Rasmussen Report's national telephone and online survey finds that only 33% of likely U.S. voters believe that Fauci told the truth about U.S. government funding for gain-of-function virus research. With polls about Fauci, partisanship plays a role. He still remains popular amongst Democrats. In that group, only 24% think he should be kicked out. But amongst Republicans, 67% want him the hell out of here. The man is a lying little weasel. But Joe Biden, another lying little weasel, seems to still have respect for that clown. So I don't think a resignation is coming. I don't think he'll be fired. And people wonder why we question this entire farce about the so-called Wuhan, China novel coronavirus pandemic. It's just another virus. It kills less than 0.002% of people who get it, less than 0.0003% of people around the country. That's all the time we have for this edition of the Truth Hurts program. Go out there and make it a wonderful, great, and fantastic day, my friends. We'll see you on the next program. Thank you for listening to this edition of the Truth Hurts program with Steve Z. Opinions expressed are free speech protected under the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. We apologize if you were offended, but we retract nothing. Background music by Jason Shaw and Audionautics.